Hi folks, the podcast you're about to hear is part of our regular patron-only pods that we do that are on the Patreon feed. And the reason I'm plugging that now is because there's a lot of podcasts coming out across the Tortoise Shack, and if you are signed up at the $6 tier or the €5.50 tier, you get your individual RSS feed for your podcast app that you're probably listening to this on now, and it consolidates all the podcasts, so you don't miss one, and they will all arrive in your inbox as and when I record and edit them and we get them out to you guys. You get early access and you get the full version of podcasts like this. Without further ado, stay tuned for the excellent Dr. Nuno Capaz, who is head of the world-leading, and he doesn't like me saying it, Portuguese Dissuasion Commission, that do fabulous work in terms of treating drug use as a healthcare matter and not a criminal justice one. Enjoy. Talk to you all soon. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are we're going back to Portugal, but we have a few guests in Portugal that are regulars. Usually in politics, we talk with João Pina from the Partido do Socialista, and we've talked to João throughout the pandemic about how things are going. But this is a bit of a different conversation. This is a guest who we had last time was in Dublin, sitting in this little room where I am. It's Dr. Nuno Capaz, who is the head of the Lisbon Dissuasion Commission. And the reason I wanted to really touch base with you is to find out, first of all, during the pandemic, you guys are the world leaders in, well, considered the world leaders, and you won't like me saying that, but in terms of what's happened in drug making drugs a decriminalizing them and making it, instead of a criminal justice matter, you make it a healthcare matter. So if I could ask you, first of all, just to explain what that means, and then we can talk a little bit about how COVID has impacted the structures that you guys offer.
Well, the health approach is the base of our drug policy in Portugal. When we changed it back in 2001, that was the main focus. Our concern was to deal with it as an healthcare issue. And so we moved basically every resources that the government was putting into drugs into a structure under the Ministry of Health. And I think that's one of the keys of the so-called success of the Portuguese drug policy. It's precisely that we have a coordinated structure that deals with everything related with drug policy, which allows us to be able to manage things in these weird times of the lockdowns and pandemics and so on.
Yeah, but so, like, listeners can check this for themselves. You guys had huge success in terms of how that managed to decrease overdose deaths, decrease the spread of HIV, decrease, you know, cause people to actually seek help and get help. And it also helped, you know, in terms of the criminal justice system, it freed up capacity there, and it created much more capacity in your healthcare system. How has that been impacted over the last 12 months by the pandemic?
Well, generally, in terms of policy, it's still working at the cruise speed that it has been in the last years. We've made big changes 20 years ago. There's a lot of fine-tuning along the way, but basically things are running even still on COVID. But then there's some particular aspects that are suffering a little bit more with this lockdown. For example, we at the Dissuasion Commission are not working at the moment. We have our doors closed to new procedures, so we're building up a little bit of a waiting list. People are still caught on the street and they are still referred to the Dissuasion Commission, but we're not starting new procedures right away. We will by the end of this month, hopefully. And so I think the impacts of the COVID crisis have been felt at different levels, I guess. In terms of policy, there's no big changes and there's not a lot of feedback immediately, because the budget is the same that was approved for the last years. So we're not sure what the effects will be in the future, but we're getting ready for them, because we know it's in terms of economical crisis, we've had one in 2008, 2009. We managed then. There were some problems. We had some things had to close, some things had to change. I think we're bracing ourselves for a new one in the next couple of years, I guess.
You've said, Nuno, it's 20 years, and that's a long time. You guys are way, way ahead of the curve on this. Has there been more interest since this COVID crisis in what you're doing? I mean, I know a lot of other countries come to Portugal, take a look, and that many countries have adapted parts of what you're doing to their own countries. Has that increased? Has there been an increase during lockdown in interest in what Portugal's doing?
I wouldn't say so. I think it's stayed pretty much the same. There was, like you said, there has been an interest in the last few years, and it we didn't saw a difference there.
And just, sorry, Martin, if I could come in. You mentioned, though, the work of the Dissuasion Commission has been on pause, in effect. Just for the benefit of listeners who haven't heard the first episode, do you want to just tell that what the actual role of the Dissuasion Commission is, if you don't mind?
Well, we're the administrative authority that was created in 2001 to deal with the administrative offence procedures that replaced the criminal offence procedures that we were opening to our drug users. Since we decriminalized, it's no longer dealt as a criminal offense. It's an administrative offense, and therefore you can have administrative structures to deal with all sorts of procedures. The penalties are basically the same as the driving without the seatbelt or talking on mobile phone while driving, things like that. So there are sanctions, there is a procedure, and we are the administrative authority empowered to apply sanctions in those cases.
Yeah, but it's more than that as well, because there's also supports offered. And
when you mentioned 15 minutes, I wasn't going there because
No. Well, there's a lot more to it, because you offer a lot of other supports to the user, and they're given like wraparound services, and they're offered the choice to take some of the services that necessarily. Yep. And they're always offered them, not like what we're trying to do here in Ireland, of the idea of like, you know, well, you get what you get offered it once, but if it happens again, you're then a criminal matter. And we're looking at that policy, the kind of one strike and you're out kind of policy. And you know, that's not at all what you guys do.
No, and the COVID crisis didn't stop us altogether. The procedures that we were already following up, because they were what we normally consider problematic cases. Or high-risk cases, we do follow-up meetings, and those are still in place, well, pretty much like these, over Zoom and over the internet, as possible. But yes, I think for the easiest way to understand the way we work is just bearing in mind that we are under a structure under the Ministry of Health. So we are part of a structure under the Ministry of Health, so our role is not to apply sanctions or to apply fines to people. It's basically to, well, get to reconnect those people with some sort of structures and eventually improve their quality of life. That's what normally all structures do.
I think that's really important, because before I was speaking, I was mentioning that the Analifi Drug Project had come out with a new report on building advocacy and working towards the decriminalization. And if you want to look at an example of, as Martin points out, 20 years of success, have you found, like, just in general, the general public, have the opinions changed towards the, or are they happier now than they were, say, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago? Are they happier now that this is the model and this works for Portugal?
For the people in Portugal?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's generally very well accepted. Statement that basically it is working, and so people are in general happy with it. It's not perfect. There's always things that doesn't work so well and that need to be fixed or replaced or just fine-tuned. But in general, I would say yes.
Do you find that, and it's 20 years you've been at this, do you find that younger people are less likely to get into illicit drug use because of the way you're dealing with this?
Of getting into
illicit
drugs? I'm not sure. I think young kids will try illicit drugs anyway, regardless of the legal framework that you have established in any part of the world.
But so you have reduced HIV deaths and deaths from drug overdose, significantly reduced them.
Yes, but it's a different thing to try a substance, an illicit substance, for the first time and eventually develop a usage of that substance that will eventually lead to those end-of-the-line situations. And, well, along the way, there's a lot of measures that you can take and a lot of things that you can do to prevent those the HIV infections and the overdose deaths. But those was back in 2000, 2001, we decided to decriminalize drug usage. But basically, it was just a small part of a huge, much broader policy change. And there was specific measures taken to tackle those sort of numbers that were really bad back in the day. But it wasn't decriminalization itself. It does not have a direct impact in those sort of figures. You need to apply some other measures along the way, and you need to do it coordinately in order to keep it functioning.
And I think the last time we met as well, that was the point you made, that people will try drugs. Young people will try drugs, you know. And there's also the point that that I've heard several other advocates make is that not all use is abuse in many ways. And, you know, we have to accept that these things are going to happen. If I could just, for me, the last thing aspect of the idea of decriminalization in over 20 years, we have the last, when you were here a couple of years ago, We thought we were on the tipping point of getting a government that were looking at moving to a harm reduction model, if not decriminalization. We were looking specifically at a harm reduction model. How do you see that the global situation? Because during the pandemic, actually, and you know the people involved in Dublin, you know Tony Duffin and the Anna Liffey Drug Project. You're probably well aware of Austin O'Carroll and the guys in Safety Net and the work that they've done with the communities that are on the streets. So during the pandemic, there has been a shortage of actual illicit drugs, and that has created other problems. Do you think coming out of this, there's an opportunity to say, well, look, we've put all these new structures in place for the people who were effectively left on the streets during the pandemic? Is that an opportunity, or have you seen something similar in Portugal where the availability of illicit drugs has been difficult?
We've also noticed some of the shortage in terms of supply. We also felt that in the beginning of the first lockdown and a few months after, but now I'm not sure how things are anymore. Well, in terms of opportunities, and well, every threat is an opportunity, right? So if you manage to find the mechanisms to solve that threat, it becomes an opportunity, right? So I think from what I've seen around the world, there's two ways of moving forward or sideways or backwards with your drug policy. It's either by small steps or one big coordinated jump. And I'm not sure if you're going to build the momentum to have the opportunity to take a big leap, or if you're going to take the small steps that steadily will eventually get you there. But there's always a lot of political aspects involved with changing a policy like this. And if you want to really change it, you need to build a lot of opportunities along the way. So it's not easy. For example, recently Norway was supposed to change their drug policy last year, but because there was some problems with the coalition at the government and then the pandemics, it all went to a halt. So I think
we could say the same here, that there was good intentions, but the pandemic has changed that, and it's just simply not on the agenda at the moment. But it had been making great progress.
But I would say, I would come back and just, and I won't delay you much more, but it's just the aspects that we were talking about pre-pandemic, when the new government formed, words were being used again about the war on drugs. And that was very disheartening, because we had moved away from the, you know, you can't hear that sentence and not think, actually, we've lost 10 years instead of gained 10 years.
Yeah, I understand. Some ways it seems like it, but I'm sure that in other ones you move forward in some other aspects.
Yeah, absolutely, and that would be unfair of me. But but when you hear it, when you change ministers, you change the people who are involved, and then you have to have the same conversation with them again that you had with the previous guy 4 years ago. It can be very disheartening, you know. Last thing. Now, are you guys doing any kind of outreach to other organizations? I'm assuming you're still working in terms of with the likes of the Anna Liffey and other organizations throughout the globe.
Martin mentioned before, the interest is still there. So we see a lot of organizations, not only on the news, but also at universities and things like that, that are looking into what we do. And well, we're basically doing the same thing. So it's there are some new aspects that we're dealing with in terms of the broadening the approach in terms of gambling and alcohol and things like that, because there's always we've also seen some increase in those figures because of the pandemic, because of people staying more at home and things like that. So it's a constant change. You know, it's every 4 years you get a new government, eventually some new ministers, but the things need to keep on rolling.
Yeah. I think that's fascinating that you've pointed out something that we've noticed as well in Ireland in terms of the as the illicit drugs have maybe decreased, the aspect
Online
gambling and alcohol, because in a lockdown situation, it's something that you do at home in an isolated environment. So it might get complicated very easily. That's what it is.
I'm fascinated by this. So you're saying that people who find themselves in, whether it's an addiction to online gambling or alcoholism, that there's an opportunity to avail of some of the services that the commission offer?
No, because those are legal activities. You are allowed to do it legally, so there's no involvement for the dissuasion commission part, because there's not an administrative offence procedure.
But there is an approach of assisting people with services that they can have.
Sure. The treatment part of our structure is actively dealing with some of those situations.
I think that's fascinating, particularly because gambling amongst young people here has increased so much. And I think it's fascinating that you're going to tackle it as a health issue. I think that's really fascinating and great progress. No, thanks very much for coming on and having this chat.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's great to have a chat with you. And we very much admire the Portuguese model. And it does have tangible results, which is great, which is reduced loss of life and gives people a better quality of life, gets them out of the cycle. And I think we can't deny that that is the bottom line that we want.
Just to remind listeners, we rely on you guys. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's the price of a cup of coffee. It helps us keep recording with people like this that you don't hear from very often at all. And I'm delighted that we got to have this conversation again. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.